Hello and welcome to Talk Gnosis. I'm your host, Deacon Jonathan Stord, joined by my co-host, Jason Memel. Hello, Jason.
Hello there. Hello.
So, great show to go along with our October spooktacular programming. We're doing sort of extra looking at the occult themes and horror themes and Gnostic themes in horror fiction in all of its different forms, be that movies, video games, or gaming. So we have, is it Paternalo? I don't even know how to say your name.
That sounds perfect. A lot of Americans call me Peter.
Okay.
It is the same origin, it's just a different spelling.
Perfect. So we have Petter, we have Peter from Cult Divinity Lost, the reboot of the popular tabletop role-playing game that has a lot of, we see a lot of Gnostic themes in it. To the point that that the Gnostic Wisdom Network, the people who bring you Talk Gnosis, have started doing live streams of a scenario, of a game. Right now, it's sort of a new thing, but I'm going to do a plug for that really quick. But if you go to Twitch.tv, twitch.tv/Gnostic Wisdom, at the second and last Wednesday of the month, we're doing the stream there, but right now it's a new thing, so that schedule's kind of all over the place. We're still experimenting with it. We're missing some nights. I'm not directly involved, but it's really cool stuff. So it is something that we want to get going regular. The response has been really good, so definitely tune in to watch a really amazing team with some really amazing creative scenarios do some Gnostic role-playing. So Peter, thanks so much for joining us. I also have to do a plug for our Patreon. Jason, I'll just do it. We'll do the contest next time. It's patreon.com/Gnostic. We need money to do the show. We can't do it without it. I wish it wasn't that way. But if you like the show, please donate for as little as $1 per piece of media per month. You can put a cap on that in case you're worried about how much we're going to run through the Patreon. We generally do about 5 to 6 to 7 max right now, 5 or 6 pieces of media. We actually do a lot that's bonus. So, for instance, the cult stream, we're not charging for that on Patreon. The Black Iron Prison series that we do is not being charged on Patreon. Our new monthly panel series Talking Gnosticism is not going through the Patreon, so you're getting something like 10 or 20 pieces of content that you're helping to bring out to the world, and only a handful of those are actually being paid. You can also do one-time donations at patreon.com/Gnostic. Also tell people about the show, like, rate, subscribe, all that good stuff if you're unable to help us out financially. Just, you know, take this episode. You like tabletop role-playing games probably if you're watching this app. You know, take this episode, send it to your best friend and say, one, check out this great podcast, video show, whatever you want to call us. Two, you know, we got to start playing Cult. So, okay, thank you for your patience, Peter. Jason, you're sort of the RPG expert here. Take it away. Oh, you're muted.
I will. This is also where I'll maybe take a moment to remind anyone who hasn't heard this story that I actually encountered Gnosticism through Dungeons and Dragons, through a friend of mine who was running a D&D game set in our real history, and he decided to use the Nag Hammadi Codex as like a reference point for some mysterious stuff. He himself isn't even a person who's deeply interested in Gnosticism, but he thought the text was cool, and then I thought the text was cool. I started Googling, and you know, many other things happening later. Here I am talking about Gnosticism online. So I think there is a kind of a neat circle here. I will get into talking or the D&D comparison. I want to bring that up here soon. But Petter, just so that anyone who's tuning in who doesn't already know about Cult, as a world, as a game, sort of game environment, could you give us like the trapped in eternal elevator pitch of the game and the universe that it describes?
Yes, I can also say that actually, I mean, Cult was released in 1991, I was 14 at the time, so it was my first encounter with Gnosticism as well. I had never heard anything about that, so it was a very a door opener for me, but it's also a lot of inspiration, mainly like Neil Gaiman and Clive Barker and all that sort of weird urban fantasy horror. But it's a horror role-playing game aimed for an adult audience. I think that's important to point out. It's urban. It's set in our world, in our time. You can play it in the 50s or in the 80s, but it's set in our world, and we aim for today, to play today. And you portray people that are sort of with broken pasts and dark secrets that live in our world, that have started to notice that things are not really what they seem, that there are some things that most people don't even recognize, that there are seems to be existences or world beyond ours, that in our dreams we may reach other places, that there are creatures among us that can't be said are human, and that there is this sort of illusion, this veil that covers everything, and also our souls. And most of the people in our world are sort of sleepwalking. We are sleeping, but some have started to wake up and have sort of started to notice that these strange things happening and things from our own past come back to haunt us. And the further you go into the game and you sort of unveil the mythology, you will realize that you are in this prison that we are kept in, and where we sort of live, die, are reborn again in an endless construct that is a sort of an old ancient machinery that was created by the Demiurge now. And in the mythology of cult, the Demiurge is gone and the machinery is slowly falling apart. So it's like a urban horror in our modern world with a god that is gone, a crumbling illusion, ancient power, sort of remnants of the Demiurge that sort of tries to mend the broken system to keep mankind and our divine souls asleep. Yeah. I would say that is sort of a...
I was just about to say, for everybody out there who's not familiar with cults, but you're probably listening to or watching the show because they have an interest in Gnosticism, you know, ding, ding, ding. You just described the problem, you know, the entire belief system in many ways, and the many themes that we'd like to talk about on the show. You know, and it's interesting. Now, I know people watch the show, they see me and Jason, they're like, there's two cool guys, stereotypical masculine cool guys. But you're going to be surprised by this, but we're kind of nerdy and have always been so. So, you know, we too kind of discovered Gnosticism, Gnostic themes through stuff like D&D, Final Fantasy VII, the work of Neil Gaiman, the work of Alan Moore, the work of Grant Morrison, Philip K. Dick. So it is, of course, I'm also speaking to people who, you know, we're actually Gnostics. There are people listening to the show who are actually Gnostics, but there's lots of people who watch and listen to the show who would not call themselves a Gnostic, who have no beliefs like that, but find the topic so fascinating. There's just a psychological hook there. And of course, it's great for telling stories. And it sounds like it works incredibly well with the cult setup. So now, see, Jason, I don't even have any questions. I'm just doing commentary. Go for it, Jason. What's your next question?
I was going to get into some of the more game-related stuff, but one thing maybe, just because of the way you described it, that I think is maybe interesting to point out, especially because we're getting right into the point of Gnosticism and its connections, is that it feels like cult sort of takes the Gnostic impulse and sort of doubles down on it. Like it's, not just is the Demiurge something that's created the world that we're stuck in, but then... the Demiurge is now gone and things are even worse, you know? Can you get into that at all? Like, this was something I found when reading my way through the book, is just how, sorry, if anyone can hear that car horn in the background, that's just the Demiurge trying to get my attention. What is it to create, is this why it's an emphasis on it being a horror Gnostic game, not specifically just a occult themed game, but specifically like for horror, it needs to double down, is I guess my question.
Well, I would say that Cult is first and foremost a horror game. I think that's important to remember, because you could have a Gnostic game without the elements of horror. And I do think that, I mean, you can play Cult in many different ways, in subtle ways and more extreme ways, but Cult is a game that is really approaches horror in a way that we try to be quite, I mean, we love the drama, and you're not playing the classic heroic characters either. You are playing sort of broken characters with tragic pasts, and I would call you anti-heroes. You're not really heroes in that sense. So you need to have sort of an acceptance for the genre of horror, I think, and I would say it's fairly dark even and fairly niche even for horror games, in the sense that we really want to explore, you know, things like trauma and mental illness and all those things in a responsible way, but it is very close to the characters, because we want you to dare to portray characters that are, you know, because the mind in Cult is, the idea in Cult is that sort of the more outcast from society you become, or the more broken you become, also the more of the reality you start to see, and society will also start to push you out because you're becoming too weird, because you start to see these strange things. So I would say that comes first, and then we have the Gnostic themes, and they are also reinterpreted in a way to sort of fit the mythology for Cult. I think there are many, like, pure Gnostics that might feel, what have you done with the Archons? what is this with about the Demiurge? He's gone. Where are the other parts? Is it Yahweh, or is it something else? There are things that probably they feel is perhaps a bit off in sort of many classic Gnostic teachings. So I just think that the horror is sort of the core of the experience, and then the everything around it is sort of, the world is a Gnostic world. It's a real Gnostic world. It's like, this is reality, and it's just horror. The illusion is falling apart. Mankind is starting to wake up, but it's a painful awakening, and there are powers that tries to stop us from awakening, and we also start to discover sort of fragments of us beyond when mankind actually were awakened and in a divine form.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's a good answer. I feel I ranted away.
No, I think that's a great answer. Yeah. I think it sort of exposes what I was sort of hoping, where I was hoping you kind of explore or go with us, is that, yes, this isn't an attempt to map Gnosticism perfectly. It's a horror game that is involving Gnosticism. Although some might say that the Gnostic worldview means that the world is a horror game. so there is there is still a connection there, which is really strong. Jonathan, I've got more questions, but is there anything you wanted to respond to there?
Oh, just that there is something particular about the horror genre, and this has almost become cliche, you know, due to, say, like A24, but like trauma and alienation, right? These are themes that I find the horror genre are particularly good at exploring and can do so in a unique way. There is something about, you know, the terrifyingness of the other, of the supernatural, of the thriller, of the fear that is inherently in the genre, of scaring yourself, of being able to construct these elaborate mythologies that really allow you to explore trauma and alienation in ways that I feel other genres can't. So I think that's that's very exciting. So really just and of course, you know, I would say those themes are tied up with Gnosticism, and you can sort of Gnosticism is a great storytelling engine, and of course there's more positive interpretations, but it works quite well in sci-fi and particularly horror, right? And just the terror of our existence.
I agree. I think one thing that differs, I would say, Cult from, I mean, there are many horror games, there are many good horror games, but I think that one thing, if you, there are like a big one called Call of Cthulhu, of course, that most people know about, the Lovecraftian one, but I think that one thing that really differs horror from that is that, you know, in Cthulhu you are ordinary people. The more you learn about reality, it's like it's dangerous, you go insane. But in cult, you are not ordinary people, not really. You are actually divine. The lives we are living now are unnatural to us. I mean, like paying bills and going to a mall, doing these, like, they are part of the illusion. They are part of our sort of physical prison. So when we learn more about reality, we are going closer, you know, we learn more about the truth. It's about actually sort of ascension. I mean, but it's also a lot about encountering ourselves and encountering our sort of our shadow in a sort of Jungian sense, that we need to encounter our darkness. That's part of, you know, waking up. And again, back to sort of the difference between Call of Cthulhu and a lot of other horror, is that in cult, horror is based around the character. When you create a campaign in cult, you build it around the player characters and their dark secrets and their dark past. So it's centered around you and things that comes from your past that come back to haunt your creatures from, you know, that you attract. So it's not like a giant monster in a far region of the galaxy. It stems from you, your characters. So the stories become very personal in that sense, that it's when you are creating the characters and you're building the campaign, the horror sort of springs from what you have created. And the stories, and depending on what dark secrets you choose to pick and or your disadvantages of your characters, and of course the game master, the horror will be very different, and you sort of adapt it to what kind of story you want to tell with that particular group. So, but I think it's a different aspect, that horror comes from within in a different way. And of course, there is a many worlds outside in the cult mythology, but yeah.
I think there's like so much richness in what you just described that I think is useful for how people look at the Gnostic mythologies that exist, because there's not even one. There's, you know, there's so many different like sort of types of Gnosticism out there. That was great. I was going to try to pick a piece out of it and ask about it, but it's just, I think I'll let the way you described that just sit as its own. If you're listening to this as a podcast, rewind and listen to it again, and then come back. One thing that you did mention that I think I want to connect to is, like, so you talked about how in something like Call of Cthulhu, the players live in a normal world and then are exposed to an unnormal world, to the weird. Whereas in cult, we're all stuck in it already, and it's not a matter of going and finding it. It's more like a matter of uncovering it, uncovering what's right underneath. But what I think is also kind of interesting there, you talked about how the players, like the campaign is focused on players and their own sort of enmeshment in the world that we're stuck in, which I think is also really powerful. This is actually something I think that distinguishes it from games like say even Call of Cthulhu, or more like the big sort of famous role-playing game of Dungeons and Dragons, where your character is something that kind of externally works into the world. Like you go on an adventure, you find things, you fight things, you come back and you become more and more powerful, etc. And even the rules are arbitrary, or at least hopefully arbitrary. Like you roll both the GM and the players roll dice to see what happens. This current edition of Cults uses the Powered by the Apocalypse system, which is far more, I would say, narrative and much less impartial. Like it feels like it's not trying to be arbitrary. It's very much acknowledging you guys, we're all telling a story here and we're trying to find the most interesting story. Can you talk about that choice as it relates to the cosmology that you've described, like, and that horror nature of the game?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's important to say that the first edition of Cult was very traditional in a role-playing game sense, that it was, you know, what you expected. You had your attributes and you had hundreds of skills and a lot of weapons. And even though some core elements were still there, it was much more like, oh, you have been given a mission and then you go out and you storm a missile base and shoot some monsters. Not all scenarios were that, but I think it was a child of its time. I think that the setting and the ideas were very big and they were very new, but the sort of game systems and how you would play it wasn't really there. And I think that this is something that you more have discovered. And that's why we have this system for the new edition. I think it's important to note also that in Cult you can play, I mean, you play characters, sort of archetypes that you sort of build upon. But you can also play, I mean, there are really four types of roles that you can play that are like, you can play sleeper characters, and that's people that are, you know, trapped in the illusion. We it's our world, basically. We don't see the supernatural, and those kind of stories tends to be much more about, you know, you're playing a normal person, and then you start to realize, you know, the sort of the first encounter, the first sort of glint of awakening, when you start to realize, oh, wait, something is not right here. Then you can play aware characters, and those are sort of the common player characters where you have started to see the cracks in the illusions. I think I hear myself now. No, it disappeared. It's more, you know, you have started to figure out that something is wrong, and you can also sort of start to see into other existences. You can also play as enlightened, and then you really understand much about our prison. I would say you are perhaps a Gnostic, and you might even be practicing magic, and magic actually works because you are so enlightened enough that you can actually affect the spiritual realm in such a sense that a ritual might have an actual effect in our world, while if you are a sleeper, the ritual will be, you can perform it, but the effect is clearly uncertain. And the last step is that you are awakened, but you can't play that because then you have sort of reached godhood. And when you come to sort of the level of enlightenment, that's where the sort of the real journey towards awakening starts. And then it's more about, you know, unshackling self from the chains of the illusions, finding your own shadow and encountering that. And that's sort of a different avenue of play that are still a bit unexplored to us, because normally you play as aware or sleepers. I think I derailed actually the question. I realized perhaps I think you asked something else and then I just slipped away.
Well, what you answered was just as good or better. And this is kind of the rant show, the show to go down rabbit holes, the show to explore things. So please feel free, you know, go off topic, speak. You know, get in there, because what you were saying was awesome. And yeah, I mean, I guess I need to start getting into these cult games that we're running. So, because it's starting to sound like an engine for exploring my own shadow and hopefully ascension. But Jason, what was your original question?
Yes, what was it?
Your sound's not working. Sorry. We've been having some sound problems. Jason, you may want to go back to your original setup or what have you.
I think I remember that you asked something about the change in system now and why it was.
That's correct. If you can connect the choice of this system or even how the system is used with the theme of the game, with that theme of like, say, pushing against systems in a way.
Yeah, I would say that what I think that this system makes is actually the strength of it is that it's much more about the collaborative storytelling with the game master. It's all about telling a story about these often very broken characters that start to realize something about their world. The world around them, and that it is an illusion, that it is not the real world, that there are things beyond our sort of understanding, and that they themselves are more than they perceive. And many of these stories end tragic because it's a horror game, and we want to embrace that. We don't want, this is not a game where you expect that, you know, the group together goes and fights the monsters, then they get the XP and the loot, and they go home and they level up. It's more likely to be a very tragic story where some people perish, some might, you know, go on the journey towards enlightenment. We rather go for the drama and sort of the tragedy and sort of encourage that to play. We tend to say like play unsafe, dare to dare to fail, dare to, you know, explore your character's darker sides and have this good cooperation where the game master is not your enemy in that sense, but is a tool to tell these stories. That doesn't mean that, you know, you might get torn to pieces or die in horrible ways, but it's still sort of part of the drama that we want to explore. And I think that the sort of search for truth, and it's more of a narrative type of story, and that the system itself sort of helps that kind of stories. And whilst the other older cult system and similar systems often tends to get very bogged down in a lot of rules, and cult, even if it's lost, is very rules light. It's very few roles. It's not about sort of, you know, now it's a combat and it takes 2 hours to finish a combat. It's not like that kind of game.
Yeah, that's exactly the kind of answer I was hoping to get, the kind of detail in terms of design and interaction. Have you heard actually from either experienced maybe as you've played the game yourself, or seen games be played, or heard feedback of games, has any of that impacted how you've seen both the Gnostic impression of the game, or the Gnostic inspiration of the game, and the system is implementing it? Like, I guess that evolution of those choices as you've now seen the game go live.
Yeah, well, yes, we are right now working, for example, the cult is slowly expanding, because right now the sort of the core rules is about playing, you know, sleepers and aware and characters, you know, those that started to awaken, and we want to sort of also expand it to play, you know, enlightened characters. But it's hard to find a good balance to sort of you can do it in the sort of what is feels correct in a Gnostic way, but how do we create stories that feels interesting, and how should these stories feel? And also when we come into magic, how will magic work in this sense? So there are a lot of aspects of the game that we are still, you know, working with. And I think that cult is first of all, it's a mythology and a setting where we have, especially I, who has written the setting chapters, have clearly decided to, there are a number of things that are not answered, and that I don't know the answers to. It's like, who was the Demiurge? Where has he gone? Is he dead? It's one of them. Why was the illusion created? There are things that I have several theories, but I don't, you know, I want to have a lot of questions to players to explore and have their own views. And I think it's very clear that a lot of players, this is not strange, any case you can guess it, but a lot of the players that play cult are, many are Gnostics, many are interested in the occult, many are interested in religion. Of course, almost everyone loves horror. And I know that, I mean, our editor, Jacqueline Brick, she sort of, her own Gnostic sort of research comes from that you discovered cult, and she has sort of gone deeper in that than I have. So I think there is a lot of sort of, you know, we are melding it together. And I think that in the world of cult, the Divinity Lost, it's sort of, this is the right kind of Gnostic, I guess it's, sort of is, because we sort of define it like, oh, but this is sort of how it is in cult. So that in our world, we have a lot of theories, but in the game, this is how it is actually, I guess. Now I ranted again in some strange direction. You can put me together in the right track.
Oh, no, that was great. Jonathan, anything that's coming up for you?
No, not really, but I'm loving it. Keep the rants flowing. So, yeah.
I love that that question of like the fact that the game and that the game is making you ask more questions, I think, and the creation of the game, the playing of the game, having you ask more questions. I really love that that process, that it's like sort of there's a feedback loop between art and art and soul, art and the whatever the real world or whatever it is that you're interacting with on a daily basis. I appreciate that idea. Like, it's something that Jonathan and I talked a lot about, is that there's a lot of art out there that might not be explicitly Gnostic or might not have been created by somebody who identifies themselves as Gnostic, yet still carries that weight. In this case, clearly there's been some Gnostic inspiration here. but I love that notion of the game continuing to give a Gnostic questioning.
I also think that, you know, the unknown is, it fits very well for both horror and Gnosticism, or like any time where you want to. So I mean, they meld very well. Like, you don't know, this is the unknown. So it, I mean, it works very well for like what kind of horror might come from that as well, I think.
Definitely. As well as a, you know, there's something even more terrifying and unsettling about the unknown, I think, right here, right now. Not to always talk about how we live in special times, but the fact that we have these computers in our pockets, you know, you used to have long discussions where you'd just be like trying to figure out a fact or who won that hockey game or what was the name of that movie. Now we can know, or think we can know, everything with certainty, right? So obviously the unknown in both small ways and large ways, it has been both an inspiration and an existential terror for people. But in a society that says we all know, we have solid answers to everything, and you could look them up in a couple of seconds, I think psychologically there's perhaps something even more evocative when it comes to horror fiction when we're exploring this, as well as maybe its lighter side in theological or religious speculations. But we do talk a lot on the show, you know, for the Gnostics out there, a lot of their first Gnostic experiences weren't positive ones, right? It wasn't, you know, angels coming down and visions of warmth and oneness, but, you know, experiences of extreme terror, existential dread, alienation, and realizing that this is that we're broken, divided beings in a broken and divided universe. Jason, yeah, your next cue.
No, I love it when you riff like that. I think there's a lot there, and I think I think Jonathan, you mentioned, or no, sorry, Petra, you mentioned that notion of the unknown being so powerful, and I think that's often the thing that that makes something terrifying is not it's not seeing the monster, it's seeing the silhouette of the monster, you know, it's hearing it but not knowing what you're hearing, and I think like I love that. That cult sort of enables that that process of questioning. One thing, actually, I wonder if we should maybe go back a little on. I think, like, I did kind of do a brief sketch of how D&D generally works and how it's like trying to be an arbitrary game, like a combat game in a lot of ways. Like, as you mentioned, you might spend hours just fighting monsters in D&D or even Call of Cthulhu. Can you maybe give, like, is there sort of a short way you can describe for our audience who might not know the difference, what makes cults and that whole Powered by the Apocalypse system different? That notion of, like, moves, is that a thing that you can synopsize quickly?
Yes. I mean, I would say that in Cult of Innate Lost, you have, like, your character, you only have 10 attributes. It's they are shaped like the Sephiroth, of course, and we also try to tie them so they are sort of logical. It's hard to get the human in a way that fits the game so it works perfectly. But I think we got it quite right with sort of the attributes. The core in Cult is that each role you make has quite a big impact. The one that leads the game, the game master, never rolls. You never roll dice. You never touch them. It's up to the players. You call to the players when they need to roll. It's up to your decision and say, like, roll, act under pressure, which sort of is your coolness attribute to see if you need to, if you can act under pressure. And all the roles follow a very simple principle. You roll two 10-sided die. Also, 10-sided because we wanted to the number of 10, so we had like the Sephiroth and Clifford in that, and add your attribute, and then there is clear level. So if you roll below 9 or lower, it's a consequence. If you roll up to 14, it's a consequence. It's a success, but with a consequence. And 15 or more, it's a complete success. So it's all about sort of what drama creates the consequences. So a combat scene or a chase scene that will take many roles in another normal combat system is quite quick in Cult. We don't want it to be bogged down by dice rolling. So in Cult, for example, if you are hunted by something in a dark alleyway and it's raining and it's in a big city and you don't know what is hunting you, but you hear sort of the footsteps, or is it footsteps behind you, and there is this wall that you need to quickly climb over to get to the other side, the it's up to the game master to call, is this actually worth a roll? Is it dramatic enough to enforce that? I mean, you could say like, oh, you get over just in time, because it's all about the drama. Is it worth a roll? And then you have that roll and you roll, and if you there is just a consequence, it's up to the game master to say what the consequence is. It doesn't need to be that, oh, you don't come over the wall, but it might be, yes, you come over the wall, but the creature is on top of you. And then you might, you know, succeed with a consequence. You might succeed, and the consequence may be, but you lose your cell phone, or someone sees you, or you are scratched on the back and you are wounded. And if you succeed completely. So it's very sort of leveled into sort of what kind of consequences does sort of the outcome lead to. And we don't try to stay a long time with these roles. We try to focus on the drama, the narrative. So, but each role instead have quite a lot of weight into it. I don't know if that, it's really hard to describe game systems, I think, like verbally, but.
It totally is. And I think you've done a great job. That notion of it being about consequences that add to a story, essentially, versus I think what maybe I'll do the counterpoint of describing in a Dungeons and Dragons or a more say traditional role playing game experience. It might be that if you're running down an alleyway and wanted to climb over something, you would roll to see how fast you could run. You would roll to see if you could climb. You would roll to see how well you landed, you know, and then if the monster attacked you, it would like roll against your defenses, and it would roll how many hit points that it would take from you. So conceivably that same scene that Petter just described could take, say, five or six rolls, whereas in the system that Cult uses, it could take only one. Really kind of getting to the meat of, I think, what a lot of these games are trying to get to, which is that moment of consequence and not necessarily simulating all of the steps. It's a narrative enabler rather than a reality simulator. Which is interesting to talk about reality simulators, as we're also describing a universe that is instruction, but et cetera, et cetera. I think that was great. So I've got one more question that might take us into some other places here. One thing that you mentioned is that like somebody who's a Gnostic who is going through Cult might be, or an occultist going through Cult might be like, oh, hey, this is not the Kabbalah that I know. This is not the symbolism from the Valentinian structure or anything like that. They might be like, oh, this is, they're taking a lot of liberties here. It's because it's a horror game, but I guess, can you get into what that process was of both doing the research, like seeing all of this stuff, and then making it Cult? Like, how do I take the Sephiroth and make it Cult? How do I take, you know, these things and make it Cult? What was that process like?
Yes, well, it was very interesting to dive deep into it and try to find a way how is this going to be used. But in Cult, the Sephiroth is sort of the foundation of the illusion that we live in. Each of the Sephira, like if you have like a, if each of the Arcods have a principle that goes like that it's represent, and Archon is of course like a power, a will. It's beyond us. We can't understand it in our sleeping forms what it is. It's a part of the machinery, it's a part of the illusion, but each of these represents a principle. So we have Kether in cult. Kether represents the principle of hierarchy that influence, you know, all parts of our society and us. So where the influence of Kether is strong, also you know, Kether is strong. So where you have hierarchies, your Kether is that influence is strong. And if you have Bina in cult, it's a community, the sort of the gathering of people that when you are sort of entrusting yourself to the community and with people, Bina becomes very strong. And on the opposite of the cliff up, sort of their shadow side, so Bina has Sathariel, which is exclusion. That is sort of when you have a lot of community, that community will also exclude those that don't fit in, and that sort of becomes the Sathariel's principle. And with Kether, you have Taumiel, which has sort of powers. When you have hierarchy, there are those that will try to break the hierarchy and climb in it. So it's all about like this tug war between the different parts of the Sephiroth and the Cliffot. And when you are sort of, you know, played cult a lot and you're planning scenarios and you're doing that, you start to see the world from sort of a, with the cult glasses on, you can sort of see like, ah, here is a lot of, you know, Tiferet is probably strong in that part of society because the allure of Tiferet, you know, is strong there. So it, when you're constructing scenarios, the different creatures and different aspects are sort of tied to this. But it's also tied back to the illusion that entraps us, because we all have like hierarchy and community and all that sort of ingrained in us. That's sort of the nature of reality, and about waking up, when it comes to waking up, it's really to sort of see this and see the sort of invisible threads. We are like puppets on strings and entrapped in that, and see that which binds us, and understand how we are bound and how we are trapped. Because when we understand it and we have the knowledge, we can descend. And that's also where sort of trauma and horror and insanity comes in, because when we are in that state, you know, in the sort of dread and sublime, we can unconsciously break those chains for a moment at least. Because the feeling is so strong that we forget the sort of the illusion for a while that binds us, and then we might see through the illusion and see what actually is there. So when we was working with sort of building the archons and their principles and working with them, I tried to find, first of all, I tried to sort of go back to, okay, what do they represent in different texts? I actually leaned most to a Swedish occultist called Thomas Carlson, who wrote a book called sort of the Gothic Kabbalah. But he wrote, and I think it was, he sort of, it felt almost like an occult role-playing game text in a way, but he wouldn't probably not agree about that. But I leaned a lot on that. But it was also to sort of, all right, how do we create the best setting for cult with the best scenarios, and where sort of these principle can come into form? And you will often find like these principles are like the themes of the different campaigns you are playing, so that if you know, if you want sort of a scenario where with a lot of hierarchy, it's also tied to Kether in some way. Probably there are like servants of that Archon, or Kether's influence is coming over you. So when you are in a place where an Archon's influence is very strong, it might overtake you and may sort of affect you. So yes, it was, you know, try to be quite close, but then it's like, okay, what does cult need as a horror game, and how do we create this interesting tug war that creates interesting stories where we can have creatures and magic and things affecting this, and also that it feels like a nice blueprint of our reality. Because when you have the 10 Sephiroth and the 10 Cliffoth, it's sort of what makes our existence, but also what makes our souls, I would say.
That is Cool. That is super cool. And I love the note of like reading an actual occult text, but feeling like it might be a role-playing game text. I think that's yeah. I really had a strong reaction to what you said in a great way. But before I dive into it, Jonathan, is there anything that you want to mention? Anything that's coming for you?
No, well, it's funny when you're talking about reading an actual occult book and it, you know, reading like a role playing book, and I hope I'm articulating myself well here and not insulting anybody, but it's very common to be critical of the communities that Jason and I are in and other communities in occultism and modern Gnosticism as LARPs, as live action role playing games, but that said. You know, it's funny that Petter read this book, that you read this book from a Swedish occultist, and it reminded you of the game playing, because the, you know, drawing from the work of Alan Moore, like when he talks about occultism, it really is a kind of role playing, right? A conscious, creative act of role playing, where on one hand you do know that it's a game, the same way that the actor knows that they're in a play, right? Now they may be fully immersed in the character; they might be doing some what's it called, Jason? When you I should know this in my theater background, method acting. But at the end of the day. They know that they are an actor playing a play, right? So this creative ritual creation, role playing that is conscious, and you know that you're doing it, but you're doing it to engage with your imagination, and through your imagination, you engage with the forces of the universe. So I think there actually is a connection that is very powerful and direct between the game that you've designed and what people are doing when they do occultism. And I hope I'm not insulting any occultists out there. I think people are getting my point.
I think that's absolutely great, Jonathan. And I think you're right. Like when we watch a movie or see a play or read a book, and we are moved and inspired by fictional people, that movement and inspiration isn't fake because the characters didn't exist. Yeah. And I think relying too much on literality in terms of the occult is probably a trap anyway, at least in my opinion. There's other rabbit holes to go down there. I think the other rabbit hole I wanted to dive down, I think that's also really interesting, is one thing that I've often said in groups that John and I are part of, is that a lot, like the systems that a lot of us use and that a lot of us are excited by, are ultimately themselves things that people have made to try to reach something that people can't touch, if that makes sense. Like it's trying to find words for a thing that is without words. And the reason I'm mentioning that is that I think one thing that you talk about Petter, as you were getting into looking at the Sephiroth, and like starting to see the world through the lens of those Sephiroth, and how you can apply them within a game context, is that I think there's also something really interesting there about acknowledging that if we're in a fallen world, that even our constructions to try to help us climb out of them are not, cannot help but have some of the grit and dirt in the world that we're trapped in, if that makes sense. So like, the system will be imperfect because it's being made within a world that is imperfect, if that makes sense. It may help get you out, but it itself is not the thing that is not the pure thing. I don't know if what I'm saying there makes sense. Can someone let me know if that sounded crazy or not?
I don't think it sounds crazy. I think I agree perfectly. I also think that the power, I mean, role-playing game is about storytelling, and storytelling, I mean, you can have that in so many forms, but I think that what you want to reach is that you know, you want to awaken imagination. I think that's core in cult. You want to sort of tantalize the mind with like what if scenarios, what if the world, what if this door leads to another place, what if in my dreams I can climb away, what if, you know, there is a lot of what ifs, and when you're playing and you have these really strong scenes and impactful stories, they sort of linger with you and you remember them. And I think it's also a way, especially since Cult is a very dark game, but you can touch upon that shadow side of yourself in a very safe way and actually go and explore a bit and do things that you normally wouldn't do, but you can, you know, dress yourself in a very broken character, a very immoral character, perhaps even, as long as you're safe within the group. And we have a lot of in Cult about like creating a horror contract, setting rules for what you are okay with and whatnot, because we really want to sort of, all the players should agree that when we are playing Cult, these are lines that we might not want to cross, and everyone has a say, and we talk, and it's a conversation of talking about them. But if people are safe and feel like we are okay with this, then we encourage people to dare to take the extra step to, because a lot of horror is kind of safe. You know, it's often, and I don't mean that you should just dive into gore, but you should dare to go to like these places where you feel like, ooh, now it's, you know, it's like if it's a movie, you want to look away, or you're like, oh no, don't do that, you can't do that. You know, you want to sort of go there and touch upon the dark, and you know, almost like a cathartic experience afterwards. And I think that's itself, I mean, that's also one of the strengths of horror, that you go to you touch, so if it becomes really, really well, it's like I'm going to use a big word, but it's a it can be a sublime experience. And sublime, it's almost like, oh, that was wow. And almost like in a transcendental way, I would say. When it's at its best, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, just the same thing with art in general, and the immersion in imagination. It's sublime, you know, it's transformative, and you lose yourself in it. Well, we are getting close to an hour, probably close to wrap up time. But before we start that process, before we start the goodbyes, which are always sweet sorrows, Jason, do you have any closing questions to go out on?
I want to underline how great that idea was, that sort of that simity, because I think that's also kind of what I'm talking about regarding that inexpressible thing, that art helps make space for an inexpressible experience, much the same way that a lot of the esoteric practices, which might be considered a form of art, or might be healthy to consider them a form of art, create a space for the ineffable. And maybe that is actually my way into my last question. So one thing that you talked about was that like the horror nature of the game means that there is sort of this doubling down on how bad things are. And I appreciate that notion of what you were saying there about getting close to something that makes you uncomfortable and how to make sure people feel safe even as they approach that. You also talked about the notion of like characters going from sleepers to archetypes to eventually to awakened, to being fully enlightened, which is like maybe their escape from the horror game. What would that look like? What does that like? Can you speculate maybe on what that end goal is of cults? Like, what is that mystery that nothing else can touch? And I'm basically asking you to describe the indescribable.
Thank you. You know, those things that we don't answer. Well, I can say you this, and this might, this is also something we, of course, haven't said it's like this, because that would be, first of all, I would never want to define it. Because I don't think you can define it. It's in the undefinable. And as soon as you define it, it sort of, it becomes cheap. Because it's, as you said, it's defined from within a broken world. So the definition itself will be broken and dirty. But, and here I think is a thing that where cults sort of clashes with a lot of sort of core Gnostic ideas. It is that there are a lot of hints, some not that subtle, but some more subtle, that mankind as divine weren't perhaps that sympathetic, because there are beings that exist in the universe of cult that stems back from the time before mankind's imprisonment. And many of these beings have a very hateful stance against us. And you could say, I mean, there is what happens when you become infinitely powerful and time and space doesn't really make it doesn't bind you. How what about morality? What would you do? What could you do? So I won't go into that, but it's not defined that but it's let's say that when the illusion crumbles and mankind go back to its divine state, I think it's not sure that it's necessarily for the rest of creation, so to speak, is a good thing. There are clearly forces in the universe of cult that don't want mankind to wake up, because they either, you know, because what will happen then? And as I said, the book alludes to a lot of this, and it alludes to our also primordial home. It's one of sort of the, we can actually see like one of the sort of worlds where mankind once existed in our divine shape, which is now just like a dead ruin, but it still exists. And there are traces of that world was perhaps not the best place for everyone. So I would say that's probably something that I don't know if Gnosticism go there, that it's actually perhaps not for the rest of creation that good if mankind become enlightened. But cult asks that question. I could say that one hypothesis I have is that perhaps mankind actually created the illusion for itself. Perhaps, I don't know, but that's a theory I have in the world of cult.
Amazing. Well, let me push the right buttons here.
I do maybe have one little bit of follow-up based on that, which I think is great, which is that I think, again, so many really neat ideas there, is that, it's possible that a lot of Gnosticism, as we discuss it and describe it, is pretty like anthropocentric, like human-centric. This assumption that humans are the sole characters in the drama and the main characters in the drama. I guess what is a Gnostic perspective that doesn't have humans as the center? I think that's really neat. I don't even know the answer to that, so I'm just gonna dwell on that question. Jonathan, you can start your goodbye process there.
Thank you so much, Petter. It's been amazing having you. And if you could tell us again, I have been flashing your homepage up on the screen, but for those who are listening instead of watching, can you tell people where they can find out more about cult, where they can order it, and so where you are online?
Yes. I mean, I think we have our homepage called cultdivinitylost.com. I think it's important to say that we spell cult with a K.
Yes.
Instead of a C, it's the Swedish spelling of the same word. So if you just search for Google cult RPG, you might find something completely different if it's with a C. But if it's with a K, you will find the right one. We also have a Facebook page, Cult Divinity Lost. There is also a really good page called Cult RPG Fans with a lot of people in it. So if you're on Facebook, we are on Twitter at Cult RPG as well. I also was thinking that we could have like a little, you know, lottery, and you know, if someone wants to have a copy of the book, perhaps from one of the Patreon listeners or something.
Oh,
I'm going to show something that no one will listen to, but we have this small Bible edition of Cult, mm-hmm. which is sort of very handy, so you can bring it with you, and it looks almost like a normal book, but people might not think that you are too weird, but it's all the text of the core rules. And it also have a PDF for the core rules if you want the artwork and stuff. So that can be like a nice thing to give away.
Marvelous. Okay, well, we will set up that giveaway for the patrons. Thank you so much. So everybody, go to Cult Divinity Lost, Google Cult RPG, but make sure it's with a K. You may end up finding something you don't want to find. Of course, I already mentioned our Patreon. Again, I will mention Twitch.tv/Gnostic Wisdom, where you can see our crew play Cult, working through an amazing scenario, a lot of fun. And for my personal plugs, check out Myland Meditation. meditation.substack.com. I'm trained in secular meditation, in mindfulness-based stress reduction. That's also what I sort of do as one of my side gigs for employment. So I actually do this for free to get practice in meditation instruction and meditating with people and what have you. So it's every Sunday morning at 11 a.m. That's Eastern time, the Montreal time zone, the New York City time zone, etc. It's free. Doesn't matter if you have beliefs or no beliefs. It doesn't matter if you've meditated before or haven't meditated. If you're interested in coming on out, just join us. And you can see the schedule and sign up at mylandmeditation.substack.com. JasonMemel.com. Anything else you want to tell people?
Not too much. Maybe I might mention that if you're listening to this and are in the Calgary area before October 30th, we're going to be doing we're going to be participating with the Law Heat House as part of their Halloween event with some creepy work inspired by The King in Yellow. Just sagetheater.com is where all the theater stuff that I do normally lives. And I'll underline there, if you're not a patron of our Patreon yet and you join, I don't know, sometime soon, then yeah, you can maybe be in that in the lottery for the giveaway for that amazing book. If you're listening to this as a podcast, that book looked beautiful. So
we'll put everybody who's in we'll give it a day or two so you can sign up, then we'll put everybody's name in a hat and we'll draw one. I hope you win. Whoever's listening to this, I hope you're the one. Okay. That's it. Thanks so much, everybody. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.